Welcome to Take Note. I'm Christine Allen. NPR political commentator E.J. Dionne is also a Washington Post columnist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's an author of 7 books and most recently co-author of One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. Dionne says President Trump has flouted the norms of democracy and the presidency, and he offers ideas about renewing civic engagement and how the U.S. can move forward after the Trump era. E.J. Dionne, welcome to Take Note.
It's great to be with you.
You've written that right now the U.S. faces a depth of division that's like what you called a cold civil war. What is it about today that's like America in the 1850s?
I should say that I didn't invent the term cold civil war. That came before me, but it has always struck me as an apt term. And starting 10 years ago, I really got interested in the history of the 1950s. And it does seem to me that there are many things in common. First, the divisions along regional lines are still quite similar, that if you look at the concentration of conservative opinion, it tilts southern. It tilts southern culturally, and it tilts white southern and geographically. Secondly, it's like the Civil War in that everybody's identities are all wrapped up so that religion is connected to politics, is connected to people's sense of identity. The Methodists split before the Civil War. The Baptists split before the Civil War into northern and southern components. And similarly, you're seeing, both divisions in the churches and splits between very religious conservative people and more secular religious people. So there are so many parts of our identity that are formed together. And it's not simply that politicians disagree with each other. It's that large groups of people really don't like each other and really don't trust each other. And that's a very dangerous thing for a democracy.
And another dangerous thing you talk about is the importance of norms and how they have broken down of late. You can't write down, as you said, rules and laws for everything. So norms have provided a very important function and aren't so much right now, you say.
People who've heard me talk before know I'm a very tough critic of our presidents. And I think that in particular, while there had been some rupturing of norms before President Trump, the failure even to give a hearing to Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court, I would argue that what happened to Merrick Garland was really unprecedented. But President Trump has sort of thrown norms aside in all kinds of areas, both in the way he talks, which actually matters in a president, and in some of the actions he is willing to take with immigration on the national emergency. We could go down a very long list. My colleagues, Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein and I wrote a chapter in our book about, the danger of norms breaking down. So norms are informal. You can't codify everything you expect of people because we'd sort of tie each other into legal knots. There are just certain things in interactions like the one we're having here where we expect certain things of each other and don't expect to have somebody outside with a club who has to enforce it. If norms start disappearing, we are in a lot of trouble as a society.
Isn't that part of what Trump supporters wanted, for him to thwart the way things are done as usual in Washington and actually break some norms?
This is a very good point you make. And there are a couple of things. One is, I think what some of us see as Trump's outrageous way of talking and crude in many instances, his supporters said, well, see, he doesn't talk like one of those politicians. And I think that was a very important sort of independent component of Trump's appeal. And I think it's, by the way, something mainstream politicians could usefully pay attention to. If you sound like you are sort of conveying a carefully crafted focus group message, if that's what you sound like, there's going to be some mistrust, some doubts among the voters. So even if you carry a focus group message, you better not sound like it. So I think that's one piece of it. But there were also people in the country among Trump supporters who were feeling completely pressed by the economy. I think of particularly people in smaller cities and towns and rural areas. They've really been rolled over by deindustrialization, and they had a sense nobody cares about us, and maybe Trump won't bring back the factories, but at least he talks about it. We trust him more than we trust Hillary Clinton. But, and I think we need to be straight about this, there were also components of the Trump vote that were either inspired by traditional conservative republicanism, you know, vote for low taxes, vote for judges, and by a backlash, and in some cases, outright racism around race and immigration. All that came together. But as you suggest, across this whole field, breaking norms look good to the people who rallied to Trump.
And you say in your book, One Nation After Trump, well, you prescribe a way out, a way forward after the era of Trump. You say there's a new patriotism that has to be built on empathy, on really incorporating that into a way forward.
You know, I like to tell this story because it was a very sweet interaction with someone. I was having a conversation with my friend David Brooks, whom I have done NPR with for many years, before the St. Louis debate that was moderated by Krista Tippett. And in the middle of that, I blurted out, if I had a hat, my hat would say, make America empathetic again. And this very nice man came up to me and said, I love that. You'll hear from me. And about 3 weeks later, a perfect replica of the Trump hat showed up at my house. He asked for my address, and it said, make America empathetic again.
One line for empathetic.
He made it work pretty well. It was so much like the Trump hat that I really couldn't wear it, but I treasure it. The idea that a well-off liberal can't understand how someone in Wilkes-Barre or Erie or any number of other towns across the industrial belt feels after losing a $30 an hour, $25 an hour job and having to trade that in for a $10 an hour job. The fact that you can't feel that this person has a legitimate sense of injustice, I don't see how you can't feel empathy for that person. At the same time, I don't see how a white middle-class person who knows that their 16-year-old might mess around, might make mistakes, but that the white person, I didn't have to worry that my son would be shot by the police, as many African-American parents do, unarmed kids who have been shot. We ought to be able to understand both sides of this as a country, and we need leadership that tries to encourage us to see the world through other people's eyes. And I think that's one of the real objections I have to the president, is he thrives on division. He's not the only politician in history to thrive on division, but it really isn't good for us as a country. And so I'd like leadership that asks us to see the world from a number of perspectives and not simply our own.
Is there a danger, though, that Trump's opponents will want someone to fight back just as hard and won't have the patience to hear we all have to come together? Is that a possible
problem? This is a question I've been really struggling with, to try in part to understand what happened in the 2018 campaigns. Because when I was traveling around, you really had two very different responses to Trump from Democratic candidates, depending on the districts they were in. And in some districts, it was, we have a moral obligation to fight as hard against Trump because what he represents is so terrible for the country. But in other kinds of districts, you had candidates saying, we need to model different kinds of behavior toward each other to show that we're different from him, not that we attack him, but that we behave differently. Abigail Spanberger, who got elected from a rather Republican district outside of Richmond, Virginia, used to say, one of her campaign promises was to listen to the voters who vote against me. She noted her opponent was a Tea Party Republican who only listened to his own side. She said, I promise I'm going to pay attention to the people who vote against me in this election. That's a very different way of behaving. And in a way, you really need both, because you don't have successful politics without people being willing to fight for what they believe in. But you actually do need the other kind of politician who tries to build consensus. And I'm struggling with, how do you bring these two rather contradictory approaches to politics together?
Is there anyone you've seen doing that well? What do you think so far of 2020 contenders?
I have to say, I have a soft spot for Pete Buttigieg, the darkest of dark horses, the mayor of South Bend. I've known him for about 7 years. I met him just after he got elected. I think he's very impressive, but his chances are very small. Looking at the rest of the field, I think, you know, Elizabeth Warren has been the most specific in offering a series of specific proposals. So she takes the voters very seriously and says, I think you're actually interested in ideas, and I'm going to put them out there. Beto O'Rourke has made a he has been on the other end of things, not offering a lot of specific proposals, but talking an awful lot about bringing us together. Cory Booker has done that as well. He says he wants to base a campaign on love, which is a rather unusual concept in this time. You know, I could go through the whole list of, you know, 5,622 Democratic candidates, but we wouldn't have time. But so you've seen sort of different approaches to this.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with NPR political commentator E.J. Dionne here on Take Note. Dionne is also a Washington Post columnist and co-author of One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. He visited the WPSU studios while at Penn State to give a talk as a guest of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. One of the things you talk about is getting corporations to change their focus, which seems like a tall order. How could that possibly be done?
My friend Steve Perlstein has written an interesting book on is capitalism doomed? And he's very pro-capitalist. He's very pro-market. But he has made an argument that a couple of things have happened to us over the last 40 years that have been bad for capitalism, bad for economic justice. One is that the shareholder theory of value, where the only obligation of a company is to deliver more profits to shareholders, no real responsibility to employees, no real responsibility to communities. And as Steve argues in the book, that's a relatively new idea. The whole idea, the corporation got created back in the 19th century to serve public interests, that it was trying to harness private interest and public interest. And so that's one problem. And the other is, you know, short-termism, where, for example, a company might be reluctant to invest in the training of its employees because they figure, well, this employee will sort of be footloose and go to the other company. I'll pay for the training. The company will get advantage of it. And the employee doesn't have loyalty because there's no history of the company being loyal to him or her. So, you know, I do think we need a new era of corporate behavior. I think we saw that after the Great Depression and after World War II, because I think, you know, the experience of the Depression, where capitalism very nearly collapsed, created a sense of concern on the part of very wealthy people in the country, people running corporations, that if they didn't act differently, the whole system that they had profited from would collapse. And similarly, I think there was an ethic of sharing that was introduced in World War II that lasted probably until the 1970s. That's why I'm glad there are people around calling themselves socialists and democratic socialists, because I think, A, they are defining what a real left looks like. I always used to say when President Obama was called the socialist, I'd say to my conservative friends, I know socialists. They're insulted when Barack Obama's called a socialist. For that reason. But I also think it creates a sense of pressure that if you really want to save capitalism, you'd better be serious about some reforms in it. And that's why the dialogue between Bernie Sanders, socialist, and Elizabeth Warren, you know, staunch capitalist, she says, is going to be very interesting going forward.
You point out in One Nation After Trump that our political system increasingly allows a minority to prevail over a majority, and that's going to be a roadblock going forward if something doesn't change.
In the book, we point out that in 2040, 70% of us will live in 15 states. That means 70% of the population will have 30 senators out of 100. The Constitution makes it very hard to change the Senate. But you can do something about the Electoral College, because we've also had two elections in a very short period of time, 2000 and 2016, where the winner of the popular vote lost the Electoral College. And there are initiatives like the National Popular Vote Initiative to try to shift us to a popular vote for president, which I would be for. I would actually like that with an instant runoff system where you number your choices one to whatever, so that somebody who commands a real majority of the country would become our president. But yes, I think rule by the minority is a terrible thing. You see it on guns in particular, on gun votes, where we do overrepresent rural America in the United States Senate. Now, if you live in rural America, I can see why you might like that. But it means that the House passed a background checks bill, which is supported by about 70% of Americans, including a lot of gun owners. Some polls show it even higher than that. They passed the House. It's got no chance in the Senate. And one of the reasons, I think, is the unrepresentative nature of the Senate.
You say that it's very hard to change the Senate. And one of the norms that I wonder, will it ever come back, has to do with Supreme Court judges. I wonder, will a Senate of the opposite party from the president really ever again pass through a Supreme Court justice from a president of the other party now?
It's an excellent question, and you've now created dueling incentives. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure if the Democrats ever get a majority again to add a couple of justices, otherwise known in eyes of the critics as court packing, you know, because I think there are a lot of Democrats, and they're raising it in the campaign, who are prepared to argue, look, President Obama was illegitimately denied an appointment to the court. You held this seat open forever, so a Republican could sort of have this
the Merrick Garland seat.
Yeah. And so I don't think that's going to be over. Now, we fought about the court before. We changed the size of the court before. I think we have to start having term limits on justices. I'm not usually a big fan of term limits, but I think the notion that a president could name someone of either party who might be 50 years on the court or 40 years or 30 years, there's something troubling about that. So that I think we should open up the system with, say, 18-year term limits or something like that, which would take some of the edge off each confirmation, because right now, as soon as a person is confirmed, that's a lifetime. And I think that adds to the pressure of the fights.
And that adds to the polarization, yeah.
Yeah.
You write in One Nation After Trump that bold-sounding bad ideas will often triumph over better ideas that seem hedged and timid or aren't even discussed. Doesn't that favor bumper sticker things that build the wall?
No, it does favor the bumper sticker things. And we go on to talk about how that puts a burden on the people with the more complicated ideas to explain them a lot better than they do. There are times when the complicated idea is better for solving a problem than the simple idea. But there's a real political burden to make your arguments compelling. I mean, you know, if you looked at the construction of something like Medicare or Social Security, it's simple in principle. It's very complicated to administer. It's complicated. You know, the rules around Medicare are extraordinary. But people got what that was about. People got what Social Security is about. And I think, you know, you've got to do that with other areas. For example, even though he lost his race, Richard Cordray running over in Ohio had an ad about job training. And I think a lot of times when people, you know, a worker who's been working till he was 45 or 50, hears someone say, well, you've got to go back to school and retrain. To that worker, it sounds like some elitist person saying, you've got to be just like me and like school as much as I did. Cordray's way of putting it was exactly the opposite. He, too, talked about how we need to help people retrain for better jobs because the economy is changing. But he put it in a very aggressive way. He said, you shouldn't have to go to college to join the middle class. And I think that's a much better way to say to someone, yeah, I'm on your side. I can't guarantee you I can bring back your blue-collar job, but I sure as heck I'm going to help you to get to a better job. I think that's a good example of how job training is complicated, but that simple sentence, I think, penetrated to people, even though, again, he didn't win that election.
We've got a media environment that seems to be ripe for favoring the more clear, powerful messages over the nuance. You talked about how the press had a couple of issues covering Trump, the way they helped him come to power.
We joke in the book that Trump is the only politician in history who could fend off one scandal with a new scandal, and that the scandals came cascading on Trump in the final days of the campaign. I think almost every mistake that was made in the 2016 election was made on the premise that Trump couldn't win. You know, I think that Hillary Clinton's failure to go to certain states like Pennsylvania, she went to Philly, she went to Pittsburgh, but not the interior of Pennsylvania. Obama's decision not to be more forceful and public about the Russian interference in the election and so on. But also the press did a lot of investigation of Trump, but only late in the campaign. And I think what you had was this desire, well, we want to show we're fair. So the press would constantly go back to the same old Clinton scandals, particularly the server and the speeches, and they'd talk about those. And then there would be one new Trump scandal after another. And so there was never quite the same focus on Trump. And he has managed, I think, is still to this day, there are so many things that have been raised about him that kind of just slip right by. And it's an extraordinary thing that we haven't seen before. And so I think that's part of the problem. The other problem is early on in the campaign, Trump got all sorts of unmediated television time. And I think the people who should be really mad about this are Republicans, because during the Republican primaries, you were more likely to see on cable television an empty Trump podium waiting for Trump than you were to see Jeb Bush or Chris Christie or Ted Cruz. He got all of this coverage because he was box office. He was ratings. But that's a problem. It amounted, according to some estimates, to over $2 billion of free television time. And again, I think the people heard about by this in the first instance were all the other Republicans running for president and all the people who supported them.
I wanted to bring up your idea of bringing focus on civics back to public life. And you write in the book this anecdote that I found fascinating. I had no idea about the Australian law from the 1920s that requires citizens to show up at the polls on election day.
I love the way you put that, because we are very much for the Australian system, and it is showing up at the polls. You are required. You're not required to cast a ballot. You could draw Mickey Mouse on the ballot, but you are required to show up, and it's raised turnout to about 80 or 90%. The fine is small. It's about 20, 25 bucks, depending on inflation at a given time, but it's not a huge fine. It's like a parking ticket, basically, and it's created an ethic of participation. Now, I am for this in significant part because I want every election official in the country to have on their minds not, I'm going to make it harder for people to vote, but rather, I'm going to make it as easy as possible for everyone in my area to do their civic duty. And obviously, in order to have the Australian system, you also have to have laws that create automatic voter registration, election day voter registration. In other words, you can't find someone if you're then going to block them from performing their civic action. So my colleague Miles Rappaport up at Harvard's Ash Center and I, working at the Brookings Institution, have put together a little task force to discuss this whole issue of what the Australians call compulsory attendance at the polls, what I call universal voting, because it worked in Australia. And we got the secret ballot from the Australians. That worked pretty well. So we might consider this other Australian idea that works quite well.
Is there really a chance for that idea to catch on?
Oh, it's a long shot here. What I would like to see is some jurisdictions try it first, perhaps a state or a city trying it out. One of the reasons I like the term universal voting as opposed to compulsory attendance at the polls is if we never got to the Australian system, but did all the things to prepare for it to make it easier for people to vote, I'd be very happy. I want to get down that road first, and then we can see if we can persuade Americans that this is a good idea. So, no, it's a long shot. But I think it's a way of thinking about voting as both a right that every single person needs to have access to and a civic obligation as well.
In your Washington Post column on March 17th, I believe it was, you spoke of President Trump's interview with the website Breitbart, in which you wrote that Trump suggested, quote, a willingness on the part of his enthusiasts to use force against his enemies on the left.
I'll just paraphrase it. He said, I have the police, I have the military, I have the bikers, and they're tough people. And I found this a chilling kind of statement. Why is the president of the United States saying that the police and the military are on his side, or sort of referring to bikers as tough people? The implication, it's an intimation of A, violence against his political enemies, because he refers to the left in that quotation. And secondly, it's an intimation that, well, somehow through irregular means, will the military or the police do something to alter our system of government? Is he thinking about Chile in 1973 or Spain in the 1930s? This was what president, Republican or Democratic, has talked like this before. So I really found that exceptionally chilling. And it shows, unfortunately, the autocratic side of the president. And you know, a lot of times when people talk like I'm talking, people would say, well, you're contributing to the division of the country and talking about the president like that. You know, and I like to say to the folks out there who support President Trump, in many cases, I get some of the things you're angry about. And I get that there is a sense of injustice that all of us have an obligation to listen to. But I would then implore those folks to listen to what this person whom they have placed their confidence in is doing, not just to his enemies, but to the democracy itself. And again, I would love us to be able to sit down and hash it out. But please pay attention to some of the things this president is doing.
How are we going to get to this empathy where we, you know, you point out in the book that white working class Americans and people of color have similar economic insecurities, and yet there are forces who are pitting these groups against each other. How do we get past that?
Well, partly we do need leaders and citizens alike trying to speak in unifying terms. And, you know, and we got to try be as candid as possible with each other. You know, an African-American will argue that or might argue that every person in the country who is white has a form of privilege they don't have. And it is true that I'm probably, as a white person, less likely to be stopped than an African-American person. There are all kinds of ways in which my skin color is a form of privilege. On the other hand, if somebody is, you know, somebody of sort of a working class past finds themselves out of work at age 50 and having to work for $7, $8, $10 an hour, they don't feel very privileged themselves. And I think we can also understand why that person doesn't feel privileged. In the book, we talk about William J. Wilson, a great sociologist who wrote a book called When Work Disappears. And he was talking about what happened when deindustrialization, the decline in blue-collar manufacturing work, hit the inner city. It was a catastrophe for the inner city. That process has now hit places like Erie and Reading and Wilkes-Barre and places all over the industrial belt. And we have to sort of, I would like political leadership to say, look, you know, in inner city Philly and in these other towns, you're facing some of the same forces. Let's fight them together. Let's try to do something about them together.
The McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State has brought you in to talk about empathy, as you did in your book. What sort of advice are you going to have for the crowd you talk to?
Well, I will probably say some of the things we've talked about here in terms of trying to put each other, put ourselves in each other's shoes. I'm also going to talk about empathy, you know, how empathy connects to freedom of the press. I think one of the jobs of journalism, obviously, that we talk about a lot is to hold power accountable, to report on corruption and abuse of power. But another job of journalism is to create the basis for reasonable arguments among people, arguments rooted in fact, arguments that may have two people who have quite different values struggling over how their values conflict, how they might fit together, but at least using the same basic facts. So to me, one of the central jobs of journalism in democracy is to promote good arguments. It's not arguments where you make up your facts. And so that to me is sort of where there is a nexus between empathy and democracy. Through paths like that, we might be able to start talking to each other again.
E.J. Dionne, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you.
Great joy to be with you. Thank you.
We've been talking with E.J. Dionne, NPR political commentator, Washington Post columnist, and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Along with Norman J. Ornstein and Thomas E. Mann, Dionne co-authored the book One Nation After Trump, a guide for the perplexed, the disillusioned, the desperate, and the not yet deported. He visited WPSU while at Penn State to give a talk as a guest of the McCourtney Institute for Democracy. I'm Christine Allen. Thanks for listening to Take Note on WPSU. You can hear past programs online at wpsu.org/take note.